It is Saturday, January 19th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio, and this is Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. I'm Lyle Troxell, and the air with me is Ben Jaffe, a web instructor and world traveler.
How's it going?
Good, good. Bonnie Jean Primsch, mediator, printmaker, and broadcaster at large.
Here I am.
Thank
large
you.
And in charge.
And Lindsay Lonnie, systems analyst, software engineer.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Lindsay, let's start with you. What's going on in the... you got into 3D printers. I'm totally curious.
Yeah. Well, I've talked about these before. I'm kind of a 3D printer fangirl. They've made them so that you can have them desktop size now, mm-hmm. where basically it's just this box that you can have on your desk or in your garage or whatever, and you can put plastic into it and schematics, like 3D schematics, and it will layer by layer print out whatever it is that you fed into it with the schematics. So I love these things. I think they're great. But now what you put into it is called filament, and it looks like a roll of spaghetti that's colored, but it's colored plastic.
Yeah, ABS plastic, I think, is normally what's used to.
Okay, and they're pretty expensive. So there's a college student who, like me, loves these 3D printers, and he saved up and got one. But then he couldn't afford to keep putting this filament into it. So he decided to make his own thing where you could melt down household recyclable plastics.
Oh, sweet.
And make your own filament. So it's called the Filibot, and you can put recyclables into it. But he did a Kickstarter campaign.
So it's an actual product.
They have a prototype.
Wow.
It's not on the market yet, but they have the prototype. It's working, and they're just putting the finishing touches on it. The Kickstarter campaign finished in 2012, and so they've got it working, and they're doing the good stuff now.
So you go around the house finding things you don't exactly need that's made of plastic, and you put in this thing, and just and you get to make new things.
It's like a meat grinder on top of a spaghetti machine, you know?
And you know, it's funny. We've had this problem for ages, the problem of printer ink being ridiculously expensive. I think that I covered, I think a year and a half ago, I covered a story on GeekSpeak that if you were to buy blood from Red Cross, it would be cheaper per ounce than printer ink.
Yeah.
Well, there's a
like,
solution.
It's so... I printed
this in blood.
Every
contract is very meaningful.
Yes,
the next
exactly.
Next project.
So now you've got these people getting rich that are doing, like, injecting ink into those used cartridges with a little syringe in their garage. You know, this is like the high class.
Okay,
equivalent.
So we're not actually suggesting using blood for printer ink, but it would be cheaper.
Instead,
thanks, Ben, for that
disgusting
thought.
Go around your house and look for old pens that have just a little bit of residual ink in them. And
squeeze
I guess,
that up.
Yeah.
Well, I mean...
So the 3D printer, reusing the plastics, I'm assuming that it grinds it up, but then it has to melt at a certain temperature. Mm-hmm. I would assume that... warming plastic to get it to melting temperature, I've tried doing before.
Yeah.
I've definitely done
smells
it.
Smells like something.
It doesn't smell good. And I think my this cells go, really? You really want to do that to me?
Right. I'm thinking this is going to be an outdoor use only thing. And when you look at the prototype, it has the front end is cut out with Filibot in big letters. I'm sure it has a huge fan in there that basically you can direct it away from you.
It sounds so much like Fusion-matic from Back to the Future. At the end of Back to the Future, he comes back in a flying car with Doc. And he like grabs garbage from the house and throws it into the engine, and it says Fusion-matic, I think.
Right.
So it's using garbage for fusion.
So I'm really interested in the environmental impact of this thing.
If we're curious.
If we're talking about melting down plastic, you know, that's something that you don't want to just do in your backyard. So if anyone who's working on this product happens to be listening to GeekSpeak, right, all
we
three of you,
I mean, I run this thing because I at UCSC we cut and melt plastic a lot. It's a common thing for construction, and we do have a 3D printer. It's a MakerBot, which uses a filament, ABS plastic filament, and it doesn't off gas as much as you'd expect when it heats up. And so I think that's kind of the solution, is it's not as much as you expect, but it definitely feels like a burgeoning industry where we're not. It's so cool, we're not paying attention enough. It concerns me.
Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I don't see these like. everyone having them in their houses. But in labs like what you're talking about, where someone's got a MakerBot and they're using it for educational purposes, or they're so like my next thing about Nokia, there's a reason for this kind of thing. There's places like Nokia, phone makers, other places that make handheld gadgets where they make quick prototypes just to see what it looks like and to get what it feels like in your hand and different stuff like this. And those kinds of places, this is going to be useful for them, I think. But you can only put currently the types of plastics in it that are recyclable that you can put in your bin. You can't put PVC or something
That's the trick. I was going to mention PVC. Let me do that real quick, because ABS plastic is the plastic piping that you see, the black plastic piping that's in our drain systems of our homes. That's ABS plastic. And it's almost everything we see around us is ABS plastic. And like this case of this monitor next to me, that's ABS plastic. And when you melt that, you can get it to a melted temperature, and you can do that relatively safely. PVC, which is also around all over the place, polyvinyl chloride, actually the vinyl wall, you know, we call records, old albums, vinyl because they're made of PVC, and that's polyvinyl chloride. And when you heat that up, if you get it at the right temperature, the chlorine gas releases. And that's not the best thing for us.
It's very bad. Deadly. Specifically not the best thing.
Not the best thing. And it also damages other stuff because it actually bonds with the air water in the atmosphere and makes hydrochloric, is it right?
HCl?
Yeah, is that right? I can't recall. Let's not do that.
That's done.
Yeah, none of us.
We'll skip that.
One of the things none of us
chemistry.
Geeks really know much about is chemistry.
One of us knew at one point.
chemistry geeks.
Yeah. So in any case, if you say, well, I've got this machine, I can melt plastic, and people start grabbing the wrong stuff, that's where it gets dangerous.
Yeah. I'm curious what numbers of plastic, because, you know, a lot of people think, okay, well, if it's a one, it's obviously recyclable, but some people think if it has a number, it's recyclable. But
we're talking
numbers
about in the recycling triangle?
The little recycling triangle on the bottles. If you go up to seven means everything else. So all the other plastics.
We should get a sticker with seven on it. Just put it on people and cars.
And as far as I know, we can't really recycle five and six very efficiently either. And maybe not even, I think we can four,
the higher the
one
number,
through
the
four.
Trickier, right there.
I think is how it's ended up. But
is that marked just plastics or is it also glass? Does glass have a number?
They don't have a number. They have a little recycling.
I love it
symbol.
When we go into what don't we know? Let's make a list.
Welcome That's to fun. What don't we know? We're taking your calls.
You can join in on the absolute ridiculousness.
That's a brilliant show idea,
Lindsay. Let me suggest that we move on to one other thing, and you come back to the Nokia story because I think that would be good.
Yeah,
you got it.
Ice cubes, Ben? You were giggling a moment ago in the other room.
This MIT Media Labs researcher, I was watching this video that this guy put together to try to figure out how to pronounce his name. I was hoping he was going to say, hi, I'm blah, 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 because I would have to say it on the radio, but I think it's pronounced Darya Dand or something like that. And one of the things I love about MIT is if you have a problem, you feel inspired and encouraged around by everyone around you to solve it, you know, to find some novel way to solve this problem. So his problem, apparently, and this is a bit of a joking story, right? But his problem presumably was that he kept drinking too much and blacking out. So his response to this problem is he created these ice cubes that that track how much you drink. So they have a little accelerometer in them. And you put them inside your cup, and as you tip your cup, every sip, it tracks how many sips you've had. And it tracks how long it's taken, or like how long between your sips. So if you drink, let's say, three drinks over the course of 3 hours, it's not going to have a problem. But if you drink three drinks within the course of, I don't know, 10 minutes, it's going to have a problem. And so when it has a problem, when it says, hey, you're going too fast, it actually has a little LED inside. And the LED is green at first, and then it changes to yellow, and then it changes to red. Like, wait a second, hold on, slow down, you know?
So this is inside an ice cube form factor, but is it also something that you freeze and is cold?
You can.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So you put it in your drink, and a couple other things as well. It is sensitive to sound, so it can listen what's going on around. So it can actually respond to music, for example. So if you have the you know, dance music, it'll actually pulse along with the music. So that's kind of fantastic. And if you don't stop drinking when it turns red, it'll text your closest friend and say,
now
hey,
that's a tool you can use.
Useful. Come and help Ben. He's having problems.
I am Ben's ice cube. Ben is in trouble.
Please jeopardize your friendship now.
Yes. So the only problem with this is...
Wait, there's a problem? How could there possibly be?
The only problem is that you can trick it. You can use a different cup if you want to drink more. That's kind of the problem.
Or use a straw, and then the cup won't tilt back and forth.
A drug person wouldn't do that.
Yeah, exactly. So presumably...
drug person would swallow the ice cube. Yeah.
Do not doubt the innovative power of a person who wants to get around the stop against drinking.
That's right. Yeah. And the way the brain works as it gets drunk, it really helps you out with that kind of problem.
Yeah, that's true.
There's an ice cube here. If I throw this ice cube in the pool...
No problem.
Okay, so I've got a lot of technical problems with this ice cube thing.
What are your technical problems?
It's cool, obviously, right?
Yeah.
I get that. Cool.
Cool.
But...
Oh, that was a joke.
I didn't mean to be.
Please
sorry.
Laugh here.
So sorry.
You know, I was thinking we really need a laugh track for Geek
no,
Speak.
We really don't. That's why we're here.
I've just always wanted to sit with the button where, you know, to trigger a laugh track. It'd be kind of fun.
You can press it when it's really inappropriate. So the issue with it, of course, is that the detection of the glass being tilted with an ice cube that's floating is actually difficult to do. And so I'm assuming it has to do with the amount of movement the glass has. So if you're just holding the glass, not drinking, you're shaking it back and forth, how can the cube actually figure out if that is the same as a drink, which involves the liquid, unless the cube doesn't float. If the cube doesn't float, then I could see it being functional, because then the tilt would work.
So two ideas in response to that, and I'm not actually sure, it doesn't go into it in the article, but the ice cubes are not really, really small, so they're probably not going to tilt or change their orientation within the glass. They're not going to turn upside down or whatever. But if you're shaking the glass back and forth, then the ice cube is going to be it's going to be sensing movement, but it's going to be sensing movement one way then the other way very quickly back and forth.
Imagine that ice cube.
If you're taking a drink, that's different. It's going to be a sustained sideways.
No,
it's going to be held.
If it's floating in the liquid, it won't turn sideways.
One of the suggestions I saw was to put it in gelatin instead of ice. So they make a gelatin cube.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So
that's actually how they're molded.
I wanted to make the sensor thing about 4 years ago, but I wanted it for coffee. Therefore, I didn't need an ice cube in it. So I was going to just have a mug that had the sensor in the bottom. We'd do the same thing to log my...
So if your coffee starts pulsing, then you've had too much coffee.
I didn't want that, but what I want to do is I want to associate my productivity and responding and doing things at work based off how much coffee I'd had that day, right? And that's not an interesting metric until you look at it over long trends, but a lot of the work that I think all of us do now is sending and receiving email. And then, of course, when we're programming, it's the amount of code check-ins with Git or something. So the idea would be to figure out how much coffee I was drinking and over time look at my productivity and analysis on response to emails and everything and calculate it. That was years ago. I never did it. So I guess I should have gone to MIT and gotten support on that.
Darn it.
My guess is that it's big enough that it just kind of latches onto the sides of the glass and it doesn't actually tilt entirely. Mm-hmm. It doesn't actually float entirely.
Or it just sinks. If it sinks, then you're totally set.
Oh, you know what? It might sink.
Yeah.
Oh, I think it does sink.
Yeah, you watched the video.
Yeah,
I think we should move on. So this is a project at MIT about an ice cube that tracks how much drinking you're doing to help you even text your friend to say, stop that person from drinking anymore.
Yeah. Or figure out your legal limit and whatnot.
The same kind of stuff is becoming big all over, especially for health reasons now, where I saw at CES they had a fork that pretty much does the same thing, tracks how much you're eating.
A fork that tracks how much you're drinking wouldn't work very well.
Where's the laugh track? Having a fork and the fork turns red, so you just don't touch the fork and eat with your hands. It just makes monsters of us all.
I still want food.
Food.
Put it in my mouth.
Bonnie, we got any emails from listeners?
Yeah. Jim in Central Jersey is asking about this whole Java thing, which I just heard about yesterday from my mom. She's concerned that she's not going to be able to do her taxes because they require Java. So Jim's wondering how dangerous this thing is. He says that he knows that some of you program Java, and he's wondering what. First of all, I would like to have explained for me, Bonnie, what this Java exploit is. And then Jim's question is this real? Is it hype? What's the problem? He says his work database web interface uses Java, so he has to keep it enabled, and he wants to know that he can do things.
All right, cool. Ben, first off, let's suggest one thing that kind of went in there. Ben and I do not program Java. Miles knows how to program Java, has in the past. He's not anymore. Mm-hmm. And Lindsay, you're doing Java? You're not doing Java, right?
I'm not doing Java right now.
Okay. We all do JavaScript.
We are all programmers in JavaScript. In fact, a lot. I spent the last 2 days doing JavaScript. They're completely different things.
Yeah, the only thing that JavaScript and Java have in common are the first four letters of the name. That's
okay.
Pretty much it.
Good thing to know.
So that's a good thing to know.
So when, you know, in technical spaces, it's very common to shorten things. So it sounds kind of savvy to say, oh, you program JavaScript. Yeah, so what's Java like? Because, you know, you're hip and cool if you make an abbreviation. But that wouldn't be accurate.
No, you're sad and ignorant.
Right. And then it turns on first, exactly. So one of the ways that we abbreviate JavaScript is actually using JS. So JS is a common term. When you write it, you will use JS. Okay. And you'll see that on things.
So where is the problem with Java or JS?
So it's in Java. Thank you. Yes, it's very much in Java. And the issue with Java, and this is a common thing, Java has a complete package. It's a complete environment that can have the ability to modify things on your computer. JavaScript, on the other hand, does not. Mm-hmm. So in the language, JavaScript can't do what Java can do. And Java could, theoretically, you can have applets that run from a web browser. So as you're browsing the web, you'll use a Java thing. I use Java all the time to log into my bank account. Mm-hmm. This is a common thing because you can do different things in Java than you can do in JavaScript. But the problem is that you don't want to be able to go to a website and have that website be able to modify things on your computer.
Yeah.
Yes. And so
is that the insecurity they're talking about?
Yeah, that's
Java?
Kind of. And so what they did with Java and when they designed it is they said, well, let's figure out how to first have the ability to change things on your computer and do amazing things, and then limit it in a sandbox environment, kind of make a wrapper around it that makes it safe. The problem is when you have the functionality in there and then you try to protect that functionality, you have problems because any kind of bug in your protection or anything in the application in general would allow someone to very quickly get past that blockade. So you can kind of imagine if we had a physical fence around the entire building that we're in, like a really good fence. The weak point's that gate, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then we have doors and windows of the building.
Right.
So the idea of if you didn't have any doors and windows in the building, having the fence would be almost useless. It wouldn't matter, right? Because you couldn't get into the building anyway.
Yeah.
But because we have all these open things that we can do that makes it dangerous, putting in the fence means that it's a lot easier to get in. So that's kind of, I'm doing real loose analogy.
So something has happened.
Well, that's the trick, is that what's happened most uniquely at this Java exploit thing is that it hit the press. That's what happened. Because these exploits happen all the time. It's a constant feed thing of another Java exploit, another Java exploit. So much so that now the standard perspective is disable it in your browser. Like all of us would say that. Ben, I think, would say that.
Yeah.
Lindsay, yeah. We just disable it. Uh-huh. The trick is it's hard to do. and then on top of that, sometimes you need it in some places.
I still have a question, though. Like, what is the insecurity when they're saying there's a Java exploit and everyone panic?
Yeah.
But don't really panic.
What's the insecurity?
What's the problem?
Do you want to know programmatically what's happening, or do you want to know what could happen?
Yeah.
So what could happen is that someone could write some code on a web page that says, hi, I'm Java. I'm a Java thing. Run me. And the browser would go, cool, let me run you. And then the browser would go, ugh, and it would take over.
Right, because it wouldn't really be Java. It would be an evil villain with a bad mustache.
Well, it'd be an evil villain with a bad mustache written in Java.
Right? Okay, yeah.
So the here's the problem is that our browsers choose to trust certain Java applets,
okay,
and they
yeah.
choose to not trust other certain Java applets.
Right.
If you can get around that mechanism of trusting this versus not trusting that, that's basically what most exploits are, you should trust me, even though I'm a bad applet or I'm an untrusted applet. There's going to be some way to convince the browser to run it anyway.
And
if you can do that, then you can run arbitrary code on anyone's machine, steal data, and do all kinds of stuff.
And to make back that fence analogy, let's assume that the security model that we're trying to get past is that fence. And once you get past the fence, you've got access to the house.
Yeah.
So what's happened recently is someone figured out by looking through the code that if you go and take a banana slug and smear it against a fence post, the fence disappears right there and you can walk right through.
That's such an interesting analogy.
So it's weird, it's complicated, it's hard that you'd find it, right?
Yeah.
But someone looked through the code and went, hey, wait a second, banana slug smear.
Yeah.
And so because of that one little thought that person had and figured out how to do it, the solution was, of course, to change that so banana slugs don't affect the fence. But Oracle's not doing that fast enough. And
oh,
so
The fix is not happening fast enough.
So you cannot run. Right.
Don't panic.
So if you happen to visit a web page that has a banana slug on it,
yeah.
you're in trouble.
Okay, so everyone look out for banana slugs.
And this, of course, is metaphorical, of course.
Oh. Metaphorical.
What's really happening is it's a bit of code that's complex and takes advantage of that little exploit. But that's kind of the idea of it. It's very, it's only going to be a problem if someone tries to attack you, and then you have no defense at all. So disable the browser. The other thing we say is only go to websites that are really trusted, right? Don't click on the link to your email because then you go to a website that might have the exploit.
Yeah, that's just generally good knowledge. When you get a spam email, don't click on any links in. But you know what? If you get an email from someone who you haven't heard from in ages, I mean, be a little wary of that too, you know? Like, we're not saying be scared of everything that comes your way, but tend to treat things digitally in the same way as you would treat real world physical things, you know, like have a little bit of like, oh, I don't know, you know, like that kind of attitude. Don't just automatically trust anything that comes your way and assume that your computer is going to be 100% secure. That goes for any vulnerability in a browser, in Java, in the operating system, in Windows, in anything, you know, same thing.
So this exciting Java exploit weekend is no different from any other day in that regard.
Except people are paying attention, which is good.
Yeah, which is that, good.
That
is,
so
and
what
your
do you,
response is...
I got a response, and I'll do it in just a second. Okay. But first, I want to let you know that you're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. That's Bonnie Jean Primsch, Ben Jaffe, and Lindsay Lonnie. We are doing Geek News throughout the show today. So what do you do when you've got a Java exploit? That's the question. How do you disable it in your browser? And I think the best thing to do is actually read the short article and then link to the browsers in question. That's the real trick. So I've got, I'm putting up a little Java explained link on Geek Speak. And... I think that going there and doing that's the thing to do because it's just a little too complicated to actually achieve this over the air. The other thing to do is that keep your machine updated as much as possible. Ben, you have any thoughts on that?
No, that's good. Yeah, geekspeak.org. We'll have the link up.
And it's up now, actually.
Oh, cool.
The content's all ugly and doesn't say much, but it's up.
Yeah, usually the links are up after the show, but, you know.
Well, that one's important
enough.
And you're thinking about it right now, so go up to geekspeak.org and do that. Yeah. So let's go on with other questions and thoughts and such. You were talking, Lindsay, you were talking earlier about 3D printing and something about Motorola. Motorola, of course, a phone company, does a lot of things.
Yeah. It's actually, I was talking about Nokia and trying to sneak two stories in there. So basically, Nyland, I know, right, is one of Nokia's community managers. And this week he revealed their decision to release a 3D printing development kit. They've already released design files that will let owners of 3D printers make their own cases for its Lumia series of phones, which apparently those are really popular. I don't have one, but what I read, it sounds like they're cool. They, as a company, they're already using 3D printing for rapid prototyping internally, so they're already familiar with how the process works and how to create the specs and stuff like that. What they're saying, because I read 3D printing development kit, and I thought, well, what else are they going to add to this?
Yeah, and that's my question.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
What can you print aside from cases?
Yeah, exactly. And so basically, Nyland is speculating that Nokia might just end up selling a phone template and allowing entrepreneurs to use that to produce handsets that satisfy particular needs of a locale. For example, this is a quote that he said, "You want a waterproof glow-in-the-dark phone with a bottle opener and a solar charger? Someone can build it for you, or you can print it yourself."
Cool. So it's not. So at first it's going to be cases, but then at some point it's going to be full bodies.
Right now it's cases, right?
Theoretically, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's pretty awesome.
Speculatively.
Yeah.
But yeah.
That's
so
funny. That's a neat idea.
I think it makes a lot of sense. So now what you can do with this, with the Machinimatic thing too, the
right.
Guamatic, what was that other story?
Philibot.
Philibot. You can take your case off of your Motorola phone and grind it up into this thing and reprint something else. I love it.
Exactly. Oh boy, Swiss Army knife people.
I have to say, I do a lot of breaking open small devices. Like that's one of those things I do. You know, it breaks. It doesn't go. It does recycled or thrown away until I try to break it more. No, I mean fix it.
And most so makers are breakers.
Yes. So exactly. So what is the spludger? Is how you actually open a plastic case? That little thing. That's like
spudger.
A knife. Spudger. Oh,
yes.
Spudger. It's a horrible term.
Can't we call it the spludger?
We're calling it the spludger.
No, let's call it the spudger.
Spudger? Okay. So the spudger allows you to pop open these plastic tabs and you always break one or two, right? So it never really goes together, right?
Yeah.
But whenever you do that, I realize how amazingly engineered this stuff is, right? It's as thin as it can be to still be strong enough. It's pretty impressive. I highly recommend opening old cell phones. It's a blast.
Yeah, it is kind of fun.
Okay, well, that was a kind of short story, but let's go ahead and move on to, well, Ben's got a story about something really big, so please go ahead.
Oh, I love this story. Okay, so We all pretty much know that you can go to whitehouse.gov, petitions.whitehouse.gov, create a petition, and if it gets enough signatures, in fact, the current limit is 25,000 signatures, then the Obama administration will actually give a proper response to the petition. So, you know, people have petitioned for all kinds of things. This one was, here's the heading is, secure resources and funding and begin construction of a Death Star by 2016. So this is the petition. And they you know, go into a little, they basically say, you know, by creating a Death Star, the government can spur job creation in the fields of construction, engineering, space exploration, and more, and strengthen our national defense. Sounds like a good idea to me. I think it's, you know, hey, why not? So, but
to
really
be clear,
cool,
you know, Ben, not everyone knows what Death Star is.
Death Star is that moon-sized object that that Luke destroys in Star Wars number whatever. Oh, is that Vader right here?
That's where he hangs out, right?
Yeah,
I think
Vader
so.
Hangs out
there, yeah. We got an official response, or they got an official response from the White House. Because right now, as of now, the total signatures number is 34,435. So, you know, this was very popular, and it got over the 25,000 mark. So, I mean, they wrote a response, right?
What's the response?
The response heading is, this isn't the petition response you're looking for. I'll just read the beginning, okay? It says, the administration shares your desire for job creation and a strong national defense, but a Death Star isn't on the horizon. Here are a few reasons. One.
Horizon.
The construction... There's so many in-jokes, by the way.
Okay.
The construction of a Death Star has been estimated... There's a link there, okay? The construction of a Death Star has been estimated to cost more than $850 quadrillion. We're working hard to reduce the deficit, not expand it. And this link, actually, it's someone put together, like, well, how much would it actually cost? Two, the administration does not support blowing up planets. Three, why would we spend countless taxpayer dollars on a Death Star with a fundamental flaw that can be exploited by a one-man starship?
This is my favorite.
So he goes in.
So this is the White House's response.
This is the White House's response.
This is fantastic.
Yeah, this is Paul Shawcross for the White House. So he goes into more details. He talks about our space programs and what we're doing in science. And it's you know, basically a really great platform for him to say, like, hey, the U.S. is doing all these great things.
Fantastic.
And then, you know... Then there was a response to that from Imperial City, Coruscant. And I'll just read this first paragraph, and then it says, the overwhelming military superiority of the Galactic Empire has been confirmed once again by the recent announcement by the President of the United States that his nation would not attempt to build a Death Star, despite the bellicose demands of the people of his tiny, aggressive planet. It is doubtless that such a technological terror in the hands of so primitive a world would be used to upset the peace and sanctity of the citizens of the Galactic Empire, said Governor Will Huff Tarkin of the Outer Rim Territories. Such a destructive power can only be wielded to protect and defend by so enlightened a leader as Emperor Palpatine. So that's just fantastic.
That's fantastic.
It's just, it's amazing. Like, this is a dialogue with a White House.
I love that the comical submission gets response of a kind of comical form, but
also
with information in it. I love that. That's mm-hmm. that's
it's
one
great.
Way to,
it's great.
To respond.
It seems like a good time to bring up what's going to be at noon tomorrow on the 7th Avenue Project. It's the subject is movies, falling in love and out of love with the movies. One of the world's most respected film critics, David Thompson, is going to be describing our changing relationship to cinema and what a century of film has done to us for better and worse, including having official conversations about fictional things.
Yes.
That's David Thompson in conversation with KUSP's Robert Pauly on the next 7th Avenue Project at noon right here, KUSP. So do stay tuned.
You are listening to KSP. My name is Lyle Troxell in the air with me. That was Bonnie Jean Primsch, Ben Jaffe, and Lindsay Lonnie. We're doing geek news this week, just stuff that we find fascinating, interesting in the news. It's sometimes technical, most of the time technical. Sometimes it's just passionate. And one of those passionate things, which is hard to talk about on the radio, so we suggest we go to our website, is our Geek Bit segment. And Lindsay, you got one, right?
I do. So there's a guy in France. I think he's actually an American. His name is Carl, but it's K period A period R period L. You know, he did something that is supposedly the first time it was done. I haven't actually researched that, but it's the first animated tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I heard about this.
Did you? Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you animate a tattoo, you might ask? Basically, he tattooed the center of it, the whole tattoo, as a QR code. And QR codes are those little blocky squares that you see on products sometimes that you can scan with your phone and see information or get directed to a URL.
So he had that tattooed on his body?
Right. So it's this somewhat large tattoo over his shoulder and chest. And in the center, there's a flower. In the middle of the flower, there's this QR code. And so if you take your phone and you scan the code, it redirects you to a URL. And you can, in the video, he sets the phone on top of the tattoo and it fills in the middle of the flower with the rest of the flower and a little face that sings a song in French.
Oh,
I have
wow.
no idea what it actually says in the song, but it's hilarious.
That's awesome.
So I'll post the video.
So I'd assume that that video is actually at a URL. So because normally QR codes are actually just a website that
right.
you visit. So he has an animation there.
Yes.
So when you scan it and then you stick the phone on your chest, on his chest, like at the
yeah.
location,
mm-hmm.
and it mixes up with the outside surrounding tattoo.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So the problem, of course, is that it only works at certain phone sizes, right? Like,
right.
<phone.
laughs>
yeah.
Well, so that's not the only moving tattoo. I was just trying to find it on a GeekSpeak website, but it's a little hard. But
the flexing sailor doesn't count.
No. Shouldn't see my muscle move. No, this was a liquid crystal tattoo, and what you do is you injected LCD fragments inside the skin, and then you could programmatically change the tattoo. So not the same by any means, but pretty cool.
I heard of another geeky one like that, where I think it was Nokia again that filed a patent like a year or two ago on magnetic tattoo.
That's right.
Ink, where you could get a text and it would vibrate your tattoo to
yeah.
let you know that your
horrible.
Text arrived.
We covered that too.
That sounds awful.
It sounds awful.
But what was the one you were just talking about? Because my mind was blowing and I was
okay,
trying to
okay.
concentrate on all
so,
the details.
So the display on your computer or on your phone, that actual screen, right?
Yeah.
Yours is locked right now.
Yeah,
it's good.
Yeah.
That display is made up of little tiny crystal. We call them LCD, and that's liquid crystal display. And
got
actually
it?
Every little cell is a thing that can change color. And then behind that's light that can change opacity. But that's how you get full color.
Okay.
So if you take the very basic concept of that, and in fact we see them in older VCRs that blink at you, that's similar. That's an LED, but there's similar types that are like that. The kind of cheap clocks that you can only see at some angles, those
okay.
are also liquid crystal.
Right.
And the basic idea is if you put a charge across that, it will change from being no color to another color. It basically changes based on charge.
And so you can get that in the skin?
So that was the idea of the research project. And I don't know if they ever got into a human being, but that
okay.
was the idea. Would you
maybe
inject a whole bunch of little pieces and wire them into your skin, and then you could potentially reprogram them.
Whoa.
Yeah, it's kind of disturbing. But yeah.
I don't know. That's freaky.
The other
it's
tattoo
not for
idea,
me.
The other tattoo, the thing, the QR code is, what happens in 10 years when QR codes aren't being used? They're being replaced by something else, right?
Right. Then it becomes quaint and nostalgic and old-timey.
And I do know someone that has a barcode mm-hmm. tattooed to his arm,
yeah.
right? Like, I've seen that.
What's a barcode?
Exactly.
Oh, so there's things in supermarkets. Okay.
You know, it's been a while since we talked about passwords, Lindsay, and you do have a story about passwords. So if you don't mind, can we do that story?
Sure. Let me skip this. So Google declares that passwords are no longer enough to keep users safe. And we've talked about this a lot. We kind of know this. A new research paper is going to be released at the end of the month by the Google security VP and a Google engineer. They feel like a lot of people in the industry that simple bearer tokens like passwords and cookies are not enough to keep people's digital assets safe when accessing websites. So this paper is more specifically about accessing websites specifically. So in the paper, they outline a lot of different and alternate ways that they think people could authenticate in the future. One of the quotes from the paper, "We'd like your smartphone or smart card embedded finger ring to authorize a new computer via a tap on the computer, even in situations where your phone might be without cellular connectivity." So imagine that you've got, there probably would still have to be one master password that you've,
right.
filed away somewhere. And then they're talking more about physical devices that
yeah.
you carry with you on your person that authenticate via tokens. So if you go to a new computer, you tap the computer, you get close to it, it uses wireless technology. But what's required for this to work is a new protocol for authenticating.
Mm-hmm.
So Google has come up with a new device-based authentication protocol that they say is, well, they developed it, but they say that the authentication is independent of Google and requires no special software, aside from a web browser that supports the login standard. And it prevents websites from using the technology to track users.
Mm-hmm.
So the only way that this is actually going to come to fruition is if all the people that have websites are willing to use this protocol.
Right.
And so people have tried to do this already. This isn't, you know, Google's not the first.
Yeah.
But they're the biggest and most widely known.
And we're actually seeing a pattern of login that goes through other services so that you go to other sites and you actually use your Google account to log in. And that's actually, it's not like you're sharing your Google account information with another site. You're actually doing this thing called OAuth. And it's actually a pretty safe model as long as it's not taking advantage of it. There's some problems with it. So this would take into that step and allow you to just have a physical thing. And security really is about what you know and also what you have. You know, for our homes and our cars, we have something, which is our key. That happens to have a secret in it, right? And you can theoretically duplicate it. But if you don't get that object to duplicate, it's hard to do that. So having an object thing is a very strong way to support security.
But don't we all know the issues with one ring to rule them all?
Thank you. I was waiting for that. I'm like, who's going to say it?
I mean, this is on a ring, right? Or at least that's one of the ideas.
Yeah. Like right now, it's like a little tiny fobby kind of thing.
Yeah.
Nowhere in the article I read did it mention that, even though there's so much like Hobbit and Lord of the Rings stuff happening
right
now.
The Hobbit just came out.
Right.
That enabled all the readers to feel like clever people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The thing that's also clever about this strategy is that you don't want the protocol to be available all the time. You actually want to be physically close, because if it's available all the time, people can be attempting to log through your system in a cafe or something. So you actually have to tap the ring and the object and the computer at the same time. They both sense the detection, and then they try to make a handshake based off of that. And we've seen that with some, there's a few apps that do this too, where you can actually tap to share content amongst a friend from the phones. And of course, it's always dangerous when you're tapping electronic devices. But very cool. Thanks for the Google story.
Yeah, Ben, smash them.
Ben, I didn't know you had a geek bit, but I guess you do?
I have a geek bit, yes. I have a geek bit and a short story, so I'll just cover them both at once, or rather one after the other. So we've talked many, many times. Actually, we had a whole show just talking about issues with women in tech and hackathons and skepticism conferences and harassment that comes around that and all of that. There is a hackathon that is going on at this very moment. It has been going on yesterday, today, and it's going on tomorrow. It's called Everyone Hacks. It's facilitated by Geeks Without Bounds. And I'll put the link up on the website. Obviously, you can't get tickets because it's going on right now. But I just wanted to mention it because so on their website, they say that one of the things that that is important to them is inclusiveness. This is a quote: inclusiveness of all demographics, race, sex, gender, language, and ethnic groups, etc., is both appreciated and encouraged. In that spirit, we've purposely curated a speakers list that spans a wide range of experiences and skills. Now, given all of the harassment news that we've been talking about over the last, I guess, couple of years even, I was really happy to see that 8 out of the 10 speakers were women, which is a complete reversal from what it usually is. Yeah. Usually, it's mostly white men, and then there's like a couple, like one or two women, you know, I don't know. So that was kind of fantastic, and I was just really happy to see that. So even though no one who's listening to the show can now attend, I just wanted to bring that up and give them kudos on the
hackathons
air.
Traditionally have product and solutions and things that come out of them that get shared. So it's very common that, you know, next week we might see a few of the winners of the hackathon. So we'll have to cover that too.
You go, girls.
Yeah. And just, I forgot to mention, what is a hackathon? A hackathon is when a bunch of people get together and they all hack together. It can be people who already know each other, people who don't know each other, and they help each other out with projects, with issues. They build projects together. And some great things come out of it.
In just a second, Ben's going to cover a whole story on an airplane. And then Lindsay's going to talk a little bit about Facebook, because it's almost been a whole hour and we haven't talked about Facebook, so we have to do that. Okay, Ben, what's up with this airplane?
Yeah, so I talked about this airplane, the Boeing 787 Dreamliner. I think I talked about it about a month ago. And there are some big problems with this plane, apparently. The FAA actually had to issue an emergency airworthiness directive saying don't fly these because there were some pretty big issues. The reports were some pretty catastrophic battery failures on board the aircraft. One of them happened on the ground, and one of them in Boston, and then one of them by a Japanese carrier experienced a similar issue in flight. And this is like a battery failure that, and this is a quote as well, resulted in the release of flammable electrolytes, heat damage, and smoke.
That's called fire.
So
flammable electrolytes.
That's really
is that a Japanese translation problem? Is that why?
Their word for fire is actually really long. No, Boeing managed to deliver 49 of these planes to 8 different airlines before this became an issue, like a really big issue, yeah. and known and everything. So that's unfortunate. Boeing is saying, you know, they're confident it's safe. We stand behind the plane and everything, but they're doing all these tests. They're looking
at
data. I have a quote, but I enough quotes. But in any case, so that's some pretty bad news. It looked like a really awesome plane.
Yeah, what was the great hope of the Dreamliner?
To be really big and transport a lot of people.
Okay, yeah.
And have working batteries. That was part of the hope.
Successfully.
And the successfully part is important. You know, as updates to that story become available, we'll cover it on sure. GeekSpeak. We'll let you know if they end up flying.
So did they ground it or they recommend not flying it?
I believe they... So the FAA the FAA sent out that emergency airworthiness directive, and then all 8 airlines that have it grounded all the planes.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're not flying anymore. Everyone responded well, as often happens with airplane-related things. People are very cautious.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, especially when they're really big. Right?
Oh, God, it's such a pretty plane, though.
Pretty!
I hear they're going cheap. You can buy one. Delivery's difficult, though.
Into a hipster cafe.
That's right. Exactly.
Bring your own car batteries.
I bet it floats and everything.
Park your Edsel outside.
All right, Lindsay, we haven't talked about Facebook in 48 minutes, so please give us a...
I wonder what batteries are used for on planes. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Not car batteries. Electricity? They're car batteries.
Right. Clearly, they're plane batteries.
Yeah. Okay. My bad. Okay, so Facebook. The new Facebook graph search was announced on Tuesday. And it allows detailed searches for users, essentially. So they publicly announced it, and some of the potential search dimensions are people, photos, places, and interests, and there's a few others. So I'll give you some examples of searches that you can run for people. Friends who like Star Wars and Harry Potter. Best liked photo of me and my sister. Thai restaurants my friends have visited in Santa Cruz.
Wow.
They also hinted that it can be used for things like single men who like Dr. Horrible sing-along blog.
Hi.
All right, Lindsay, have you tried that?
I have not tried that yet.
You know, so this search is available to all Facebook users at this point?
Yeah, they said they announced it. Normally, they roll things out to a small user group first. I haven't checked. I'll double check on that and let you know.
So something's changed on Facebook, which means there's probably more security privacy mm-hmm. things you have to do, right?
That is exactly it.
Oh, no.
So every time I talk about these things, it's basically just a public service announcement. Check your privacy settings. Mm-hmm. So,
except you need a doctorate to understand your privacy settings.
I've been reading all these conflicting articles about this. So people are freaking out. There's this new feature. Everyone's going to be able to see my info. It's not like that. You should still only be able to see the things that people have made either public. So the tricky thing I have found with Facebook is, by default, things are usually set to friends of friends.
Right.
But if your friend tags you at a restaurant, then their friends of friends can see it.
Yeah. Right.
So that's the only kind of iffy sector. So when you're tagging people or checking them in someplace, just be cautious about what your settings are, because they may not want people, your friends of friends, knowing that they were at that restaurant. You know?
Yeah, why
so
not
it's just
ask?
A courtesy
why
thing.
Why isn't that like, can I ask if I can take your picture? Can I ask if I report that you are here with me?
That's exactly what it should be.
And if you're tagged in a photo and you have only share with friends and your friend posts that, shouldn't it respect your... It should respect the more secure or more private setting.
It should.
Right?
But I did read that you can't opt out of search anymore, that they removed that feature last month.
Yep.
And the other thing is that...
They said that only a single-digit percentage of users... had opted out when the choice was available.
Therefore, their opinions do not matter.
That's like 10 million is like 1%.
Yeah, and a single digit percentage of user could be 9% of users. And also, once Graph Search rolls out to everyone, right, don't you think that number might go up?
Right. So the other thing is, you say that it was supposed to respect your opinion, but Facebook's building a profile about you based off of private and public information. And if you're tagged in a friend's photo multiple times or in a post and the discussion is around the Thai place in Scotts Valley, then Facebook kind of knows you like Thai food in Scotts Valley. And you don't have to show anything about those posts or anything for that knowledge to be shared. And so mm-hmm. how do you say the information you accumulate about me that you know about me is private? It might not be.
Mm-mm.
And the other thing, though, the search sounds very Wolfram Alpha kind of style.
They're
right?
using Bing.
They're using Bing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they've partnered with Bing.
They're using Bing.
Does that mean
with
Microsoft
Maps
actually
too.
Gets this data?
What?
Does that mean that the data is actually being transferred over to Microsoft?
Just assume so, right? I mean,
yeah,
don't we just assume so?
Oh, sure. It's on the internet. Thing.
Always assume.
And it's not
that
for us anyway,
there's...
right? It's for advertisers and people who want to market to us that this is a thing now. I'm assuming.
Hey,
I'm
it's assuming. Free. No. Oh, hey, it's free. I'm going to put all my information up there. No, assume that they are going to use it for their needs. If you have something private, don't put it
up.
Did
you say nefarious
the
or just needs?
That was in between those words.
That was the breath you took.
The other thing is when you say free, of course, you really mean if you use it, they are getting what they want from you. You know, they don't want
you're
money
paying.
From you.
Yeah. Oh, you'll
they
pay.
Want data
you
from you.
Use it. Yeah.
So, also, I had read that it doesn't work so well. There was a CNN article that I read that said that it said, according to Facebook's new search feature, only two of my 526 friends like cats. judging by the number of cat photos filing in my feed every day, this is obviously not accurate. So, you know, of course, I mean, that's not really news, though. I mean, of course, a new feature is going to be not 100% complete. It's a good idea. It's scary, though, to me, I think.
So this search thing is not on for everybody yet. Is
no.
that right?
Okay.
Is that right?
I don't know.
Because I'm trying to find it. I'm trying to figure it out.
No,
it hasn't been rolled out to everyone.
All I know is that the things they've rolled out in the past have always been, that I'm aware of, a small group and then everybody.
You know that like the searches of, you know, which of my friends wears shoes is going to respond with, none of your friends wear shoes, right?
Because right? Like, who's going to go and like, well, a few people are going to go and like shoes.
It's true. It'll be like one person. Ben doesn't like shoes, but
Amanda.
He talks about shoes a lot. Uh-huh. They must be a nightmare thing.
All of my likes on Facebook are shoes, high-end shoes.
The other thing is if you're talking, let's say you talk about like you have a fear, right? And so you're talking a lot about that fear. Like I'm scared of Facebook. And so no, let's use a different fear. I'm scared
Spiders.
Of shoes. Let's say shoes. I'm really scared of shoes. So then you're kind of tagged this idea of shoes, right? So then, hey, you know, these people are friends of yours and they talk about shoes a lot. You're like, what? I don't like shoes. Like the not aspect, the desirable quality is desirable.
It just proves that what you resist
undesirable
sticks to you.
It is. It's true. It's true.
I'd
Maybe it'll be a growth thing. Maybe we'll think about this as a learning experience for us spiritually.
I'd be interested to ask Facebook how many of my friends dislike Facebook and just see what it says.
Ask your friends on Facebook, yeah.
No, ask Facebook how many of my friends dislike Facebook, you know?
Yeah.
Instead of how many of my friends like cats.
Of course, you could post that on your page, too.
I dislike Facebook.
Well, they don't have a dislike option.
Or how many people are scared of Facebook?
Like this if you don't like this. Is that what you'd say?
That's like Prop 8.
A double positive makes a negative.
All right, I feel like we've successfully covered Facebook. Thank you for the search thing. It's interesting that Bing, the engine behind it's Bing. I love to see how this upsets people. I'm sure it will. So this will be fun to see. And, of course, relatively soon we'll have a whole description on how to turn it off.
Well,
if we can.
If
one
Facebook,
way is to, of course, delete your account.
Of course, Facebook may have learned from Apple not to release their own Maps feature. You know,
yeah. You know, one of the things every year on Geek Speak, we come around the beginning of the year and we think, oh, let's do predictions and stuff. But we've done so. Predictions are kind of whatever. And we always kind of talk about the future to some degree on Geek Speak. So I didn't do that. But one thing I want, it's not a prediction, but I would like us to replace Facebook's abilities and qualities with something that's not owned by a corporation. Some kind of infrastructure change.
An open source one that is therefore more private.
Yes. And I would, more about the service versus about getting a company to raise revenue. Like, that's what the Facebook system is about, right?
Yeah. Hey, we had a question come in from a fellow by the name of Sam.
Okay.
And he's curious about audio engineering stuff. He's wondering about sound and sound waves and how they're transformed, like changing the speed of a song but not the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
And he's wondering if there's some software out there that would let him play with the very core of sound waves.
Oh.
He wants to be able to apply mathematical equations to the sound waves.
Okay.
Like, really get in there.
All right.
Does such a thing exist?
Yeah.
And derivatives and stuff. You know what? I think I got an email from this Sam guy. This Sam guy, I think, is my brother.
Okay.
Ben. He's my brother.
How do sound waves get sped up without sounding faster?
That's a really difficult question.
Isn't it?
So
the way it's done is, I mean, like, if you take a tone and you force that tone into another sound, you modify it by slicing it up in a different way than you'd normally speed it up. So it's not sped up, it's sliced up and compressed, if you will. That's why it sounds so bad, right? You hear those auto-tuned things and there's a quality about them. That's the artifact of that technology. And it is, I believe, about slicing it and compressing it at a certain way. And I think you, and I'm not sure exactly where that happens, but I think it happens at the nodal point of the sine wave. You think you take a bit of it out, and therefore the side effects that get produced, you do a small enough slice, the side effects are high enough frequency that they get cut out. So it's kind of that manipulation.
Really hard thing to talk about on the radio, though. But as far as his second part of his question,
playing with the math,
Lyle, do you know of any software that you could do stuff like that?
So the one I'm going to suggest is using processing.org. It's a Java and JavaScript library. How confusing is that? Those are two different things.
Java and JavaScript.
Uh-huh. JavaScript. But it runs on your local computer, and you can play programmatically with audio. In fact, that's how I teach what a sine wave and how analog works, is I take up processing, I throw it up in front of a room, hook my computer up to it, and then write some sine waves algorithms and run it, and then you can do transforms and hear what it sounds like. So it's really cool, and you can visualize it as well. So processing.org, in fact, processing.org's, if you go there, the learning area has a whole section on audio, and you can download the app and open that experiment or that trial inside the processing library. It's all open source. You can save it and then put it on your website, and then you could, you know, don't put banana slugs in it. It's all the thing.
Yes, whatever you do.
Not metaphorical ones, at least.
Of any kind.
Well, we have come to the close of a show again. This is Geek Speak in the Air with me, Bonnie Jean Primsch. Thank you so much for being here. You'll be here next week with me?
Yeah.
Great. And Lindsay Lonnie, also in the air room. Thank you, Lindsay, for being here.
My pleasure.
And, of course, Ben Jaffe. Now, it's going to be a while for you guys, right? You're going to be gone for a while, Ben, traveling?
I'm gone for 1 week, then I'm back, then I'm gone in...
A long time.
Yeah, a long time.
We'll talk about that again. I'm Lyle Troxell. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence. He's used with permission. We will see you next week. Of course, stay tuned for Car Talk. Thanks for listening. And remember, you can learn more about the show at geekspeak.org.